Okay, we're on. So, welcome. Thank you for coming. We're in Roseville, Minnesota today on April 12th, 2011, and we're talking about ethics. This is Ethics Refresher. The materials here say part two, but it's really hour number four of a six-hour program. I presented this previously a few weeks ago, the first part of it, and this is a continuation of that program. So, any 3 hours will satisfy your ethics requirements in Minnesota and Wisconsin. If you want more, though, you can. The rest of the program will be available. Or if you're reporting this year, you can take the other 3 hours after the cutoff. But many of the ethics programs that you go to invariably feature something like a panel discussion, and it's treated kind of like a soft topic. And that's appropriate because many times the kinds of things we're talking about, there are a lot of gray areas, there are a lot of dilemmas that come up, and some of those you just have to talk about. But one thing that's not done very often is just an opportunity to go through the rules in their entirety and see what's there. And that's what we're going to be doing today. You might have flashbacks because you probably haven't heard this for a long time, but what we're going to do today will seem vaguely familiar with that multi-state professional responsibility review course that you took back in law school, because that's what we're going to do, is just be walking through the rules and talking about them. We won't be talking too much about those gray areas because, again, they're covered in a lot of ethics programs. But as you'll see, there will be many of those because a lot of times there are two conflicting rules that you have to worry about. For example, one easy one, well, not an easy one, but an easy common problem or an easy to cite problem is, you owe a duty of confidentiality to your client. But on the other hand, in some situations, if you think your client is going to commit a crime, there's a duty to report that. Sometimes there's a middle path between those two competing obligations. Sometimes that middle path is pretty wide. Sometimes, though, that middle path is very narrow. There, in many of those situations, a lot of times there's not an easy way out, or there's not a safe side that you can take. You have to navigate that position right down the middle and get the correct answer, not just err on the side of caution. Because of that, because of these conflicting obligations that you sometimes have, and sometimes because when you're involved in a case, tunnel vision kind of takes over, and it's just sometimes it's very difficult to see these problems or to see how to avoid them. Often the problem is very apparent, but how to avoid it is not. Sometimes running it past somebody else is a good idea because sometimes it will just be very apparent what the correct answer is. You have to use some caution doing that, though, because, again, you have that confidentiality rule. If you have this ethical dilemma, based upon confidentiality, you can't just run this problem past anybody. But this is one case where there is a safe harbor in the rules, and it's actually, I forget the rule number because we covered it in the first part, but there is an exception to client confidentiality for situations where you're seeking legal advice on how to proceed under the rules. So keep that in mind. Make sure, though, that that's not a non-lawyer that you talk to. We had the Minnesota Supreme Court had a case this past summer. It was actually not an attorney discipline case. It was a whistleblower case. And the guy had a pretty good whistleblower case, but he lost it because he, during the course of how to deal with this dilemma of how to deal with this these ethical problems representing his client, he ran the problem past his father, who was a retired businessman but not a lawyer. And the court was a little bit troubled with the case, and they were kind of looking for a reason to throw it out, and that was provided an easy reason. But you want to avoid that because that's not an exception to client confidentiality. One other thing to keep in mind is that in Minnesota and probably in Iowa and Wisconsin, the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility will provide advisory opinions. So if you run into something, you can just call them up and say, I want an advisory opinion on this. And as long as you fully disclose the facts, that provides you with protection if you act upon their advice. In theory, you could still get into trouble for acting upon their advice, but it has never happened. Two cautions about that, though. One is, if you're going to do that, you have to disclose all of the relevant facts to them. You can't just say, my client owes me $100, can I take it out of the trust account? And then not say, oh, but I also owe him $100. So you have to fully disclose everything that's going on. And also, one word of caution there is that the answer you get will probably tell you to take the moral high ground. So if you think you're entitled to this money in your trust account, and you call them up, they work hard and they want to make their job as easy as possible, and the way for them to make their job as easy as possible is just to say, give the money back to the client. And then you're kind of stuck, because if you want to rely upon their advice, you actually have to follow their advice. So keep that in mind. One other resource that I did not include here, because it's pretty new, the former director of the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility, William Wernz, has just written an e-book. Actually, it's in the process of being written, and it's about half finished. But it's available free online from the State Bar Association to anybody. And you think reading about ethics, that doesn't sound like a fun read, but it's actually, given the subject, it's actually a pretty interesting read. So you can kind of look that over, and that can help you in some of these things. One thing that Mr. Wernz talks about in his book is that there's kind of this common perception that lawyers these days aren't very ethical, which may or may not be true. But the other part of that is this myth that there was this past golden age when lawyers were all good, and somewhere along the way we all turned bad. Well, he kind of dispels that myth pretty well, and there really never was this golden age of attorney ethics. The problems might have been different, but there were still problems even in any supposed golden age. So I guess our job is to make sure that lawyers in the future look back and say, 2011, that was the golden age of attorney ethics. And to do that, we're going to plot our way through the rules and figure out what those ethical responsibilities are. A lot of the substantive rules were covered in the first part. If you have the opportunity to take that one at some point, you might want to, because the meat of it is in some of those rules. But there's quite a bit of meat that we'll be covering today, and you have the materials here for the full following 3 hours, and we'll get through about an hour's worth of that today. Well, we covered up through Rule 4 previously, and we start with Rule 5.1, and that talks about not the responsibility of the individual lawyer who's working on something, but the kind of the respondeat superior liability of the attorneys above him. And then in a minute we'll talk about what are the obligations of the attorneys under another attorney. But in general, and most of these rules always start by stating a general rule and then usually specify a few exceptions to it. And here in the case of Rule 5.1, talking about partners in a law firm or any lawyer who has is a supervisor or in a managerial authority, not only does he have to watch out for what he does, but he or she needs to make reasonable efforts to ensure that there are measures in place reasonably assuring that all the lawyers under him or her conform to the rules. So, basically, the rule is for the people in a managerial position in a law firm or with somebody working under them, you basically can't take a head-in-the-sand approach. You can't say, I was unaware that these ethical things were going on, because that's not a defense if you could have put some means in place to make sure that didn't happen. So you can't say, well, I didn't know that my associate was embezzling the money. Well, you would have known that if you would have opened the bank statements once in a while. So some reasonable effort has to be in place to prevent against people underneath you from doing things. And that also applies to any attorney who has kind of a supervisory authority. Getting back to more of the common law respondeat superior, you are also liable for somebody under you if you ordered the conduct. That's pretty obvious, or if you ratified the conduct. So if you tell your new associate, you know, forge this document for me. Obviously, you're going to be in trouble for doing that. Or if they come to you with the forged document and you know, you say, good forgery, if you ratify the conduct. Or if you know that they're doing something and you have time, you have the opportunity and time to mitigate that and fail to do so. So that you see that one of your one of the people underneath you has done something wrong. If it's still possible to correct that error, you have an affirmative obligation to go ahead and do that. So that's Rule 5.1. Basically, you're responsible for the things that you know about, plus you have an obligation to put measures in place to keep bad things from happening. Well, that's the supervisor. Rule 5.2 covers the underling, somebody working at the direction of another attorney. First of all, it says that I was only following orders is not a defense. A lawyer is bound by the rules even if he or she acted at the direction of another person. I think that's pretty obvious. If your boss tells you to do something that you know is prohibited by the rules, and if you do it, you are responsible just as much as he or she is. However, there is a little bit of an exception here, because there are some gray areas, as we pointed out. There are some that are very black and white, but there are some gray areas. So this does provide a safe harbor if you are following orders, if there is a kind of an ethical problem here possible, and the supervisor makes a reasonable resolution to that problem. His or her resolution to the problem does not necessarily even have to be correct, but it does have to be reasonable. A question like of confidentiality. I owe confidentiality to my client. The only exception to that is when you're required to report somebody else. The supervisory lawyer might guess wrong and say, yes, you are required to turn in your client for this misconduct. And if you do so, as long as that order was reasonable, then the lower level attorney is protected. Well, those rules talk about two tiers of lawyers. Rule 5.3 talks about non-lawyer assistants. Secretaries, paralegals, basically anybody that you have working for you in a law office. The fact that your paralegal forged the document does not necessarily let you off the hook. Because, first of all, any lawyer in the firm with any kind of managerial authority, a partner or somebody who's supervisory, must take reasonable efforts to make sure that everyone acts in conformance with the lawyer's professional obligation. So, the secretary doesn't have any obligation to protect confidential information. Secretaries can't be disbarred or suspended, but the lawyers can. So when you delegate things call your professional obligations into question, you have to make sure that there's a system in place and that's done in such a way so that those people will comply with your obligations. That's kind of the general rule. There's this affirmative obligation to guard against these things. And then the rule also kind of adopts the common sense, you know, kind of the common law respondeat superior point of view, that obviously if you order somebody to do misconduct, then you are responsible for that. Or if you ratify it, you know, the secretary comes in with the forged document and you say that they did a good job. And again, if you know that they're doing something wrong, even if you didn't have an obligation to prevent against it in the first place, so it's, for example, it's not your secretary, but it's your partner's secretary. You know, you're probably not responsible, but if you become aware of something and fail to take corrective actions, then you yourself are in trouble. So that's kind of the employer-employee things that we're talking about. Next, we move on to the professional independence of the lawyer. And this theme kind of runs through the rules. One of the first rules, I think it's rule 1.2, basically says that the client is in the driver's seat, that, you know, basically, you as an attorney just follow your client's directions, with some exceptions, like you know, helping him commit a crime or something. But that's kind of the general overarching principle of the rules, that the client is in charge. And rule 5.4 goes into a little bit more detail on that, basically saying that, basically making sure that you're free of any ties that would keep you from independently keeping your client in the driver's seat. Well, first of all, it talks about sharing your fees. If somebody pays you for legal work, they pay you a fee, presumably, and that's okay. But since they are paying for legal advice and legal services, all of that money has to go to lawyers. You can't share a fee with a non-lawyer in any way, subject to a few exceptions. So, for example, you can't. This is the main reason why, and we'll get into some more specifics later. But basically, that's the reason why you can't pay referral fees to people. So, if you you know, tell people, if you see a car accident, you know, you'll get half of my fee or $100 or whatever if you refer that person to me, because that's sharing your fee with a non-lawyer, which is in general not permitted. But there are a few exceptions, but they're pretty narrow exceptions, and some of these they're covered in more detail in the rule. Payments to the lawyer's estate after his death. But again, there are some exceptions there. So you, the attorney, earned part of the fee on the case, and then you pass away, and your partner or somebody else in your firm takes over. Well, payments, your fee basically can be paid to your estate. The surviving lawyers are not subject to discipline for paying your fee, even though it goes to your relatives after your death. If you purchase the practice of a deceased or disabled lawyer or disappeared lawyer, I've never quite figured out how you can purchase the practice of the disappeared lawyer, because where do you send the check to pay for it? But in any situation where this lawyer is either deceased or disabled or disappeared, then he's not a lawyer anymore, but you can still share the fees with that person, subject to the other rules. There, it is permitted, but there are some regulations that you have to look at. You know, some kind of a profit sharing plan for your non-lawyer employers, that's permissible. But again, you have to consult the rules to get the specifics, and that's not one area we're going to cover in detail. And also, if you're kind of a public interest lawyer and you get court awarded attorney's fees, if you're representing the Friends of the Spotted Owl Inc. and you get attorney's fees, it's permissible for some of those attorney's fees to go directly to that nonprofit organization. with, even though non-lawyers will be sharing in that. But again, there are some pretty specific conditions to that in the rules. So you have to cover that. Okay, again, we're talking about independence of a lawyer. And again, the fee is something that makes you dependent. So that's why we're talking about fees under the heading of independence. But you can't form a partnership with a non-lawyer if one of the activities of the partnership is the practice of law. So for example, if you and an accountant decide to share an office and you do the legal work and the accountant does the accounting work, that might be a pretty reasonable setup, but you can't do it as a partnership so that you get 50% of the accounting fees and he gets 50% of the legal fees. So as long as one of the activities of the partnership is the practice of law, then it can't be done as a partnership. Now the next one, this really puts it why we're talking about fees under independence. A lawyer may not have his or her services directed or regulated by the person who recommends, pays, or employs him. You know, you get a call at midnight from somebody saying that their son was just arrested for DWI. Can you represent the son? Yes, you can, and you want to get paid. So maybe you talk about how much it's going to cost, and they say, okay, we'll bring over the money to pay his fee. Well. The mere fact that they're giving you money, I mean, you know, normally when you go into some place and hand over money, you know, the customer is always right. But here they're not. They are not the customer. They are not the client. They are just the people paying the fee. So, you know, that can run into conflicts because, for example, if Junior wants to plead not guilty and get off on a technicality, and, you know, the client is in the driver's seat. So he has that right to make that decision. Even if the parents say, no, we paid you $1,000 because we want you to, you know, have him plead guilty and put him in treatment or whatever. Well, that might be a reasonable thing for them to decide, but that's one of the things that's the client's decision. You know, very client, you know, I mean, you can't get any more of the client's decision on that, whether to plead guilty or not guilty. That is the client's decision. So the mere fact that somebody else is paying doesn't change that. Which also means as a practical matter in a situation like that, you probably want to get your fee up front because once you've alienated the people writing the checks, they might stop writing the checks. And as we've covered in the other section, you might not be able to get out of the case just because the money's not coming in. But again, your client is the client. Your client is not necessarily the person paying the fee. And then there are another area that we're not going to cover in great detail. You could violate the literal terms of some of these rules with a professional corporation or professional association. And so there are rules covering those specifically. For example, if for tax reasons the spouse owns a portion of the professional corporation or something. Then the non-lawyer spouse is sharing the fees, but there might be a rule that covers that. So if you in a situation like that, you should consult the rule. So the lawyer needs to be independent, and that a lot of times boils down to the fee. That's what Rule 5.4 covered. Well, now we're going to move on to the unauthorized practice of law. This is one where the three states we're covering will start departing a little bit. Today's program is covering the rules as they exist in three states, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa. And in general, it covers about another 42 states as well, because all of these states have adopted the ABA model rules of professional conduct. So the rules are pretty much the same, but every state has a few little tweaks, and And so in this case, the three states start departing a little bit. So when there is an exception for a particular state, we'll cover that. But in general, what I'm saying applies in all three states. Well, there's no rule in the rules of professional conduct against the unauthorized practice of law because the rules cover the conduct of lawyers. So by definition, if the rules apply to you, you can't engage in the unauthorized conduct of law in general. But there might be some situations where that could happen. And so that's what Rule 5.5 talks about. And in particular, where that can come up pretty easily is something crossing jurisdictional boundaries. So for example, you know, I'm admitted in Minnesota and I have a case pending in Minnesota. Can I go to Wisconsin to take a deposition in that case? That's what this rule talks about. Or can I file the case in Wisconsin? That's what these questions talk about. Or can I give advice to the people in Wisconsin? Well, the general rule is that you are only allowed to practice in the jurisdiction in which you are admitted. So if you're admitted in Minnesota, in general, you can only practice in Minnesota. You can't, if you don't have a Wisconsin, if you're not admitted in Wisconsin, you can't, you probably can't go to, you know, Madison and set up an office there and practice law. You might be able to, but in general, you can't. So the general rule is that you're not allowed to practice law in other jurisdictions, but you have to define what that means, and the rule goes into more detail. Wisconsin throws in a specific provision saying you can't assist somebody else in doing that. I think that's probably covered by the other rules anyway that we talked about previously, Wisconsin made that a little bit more specific. So that's the general rule. You can't practice law in other states. However, there is an exception. It's kind of a big exception. If you were admitted in your home state, you do not violate the rule. If you go to another state, if the same conduct would have been, it's okay, provided the following are met. Here are the exceptions, and there are some pretty broad exceptions. You can work in association with another lawyer in that state, and that is permitted. So there will be rules in that state that have to be followed. Usually, like in Minnesota, in the general rules of practice, it covers what the rules are for pro hac vice admission. But if you are permitted to do so in that other state, to act along with another attorney admitted in that state, that is permissible and that does not violate the rules. The second one is a little bit more difficult to define, but kind of covers the situation of, you have to take a deposition in your Minnesota case, and can you take that deposition in Wisconsin? And the answer is probably yes. Because there's an exception for services that are reasonably relating to a pending or potential proceeding. We're actually on number three here. the deposition in another state. No, we're on number four. things that arise out of an attorney's practice in the state where he or she is admitted. So, for example, taking a deposition in another state, that would come under this paragraph 4. The other ones here are in paragraph 2, you're allowed to do things in preparation for a case that you reasonably believe that you will be admitted in. So, if you look at the Iowa court rules, you as a Minnesota attorney, and you see hypothetically that Minnesota attorneys are routinely admitted pro hac vice to practice law in Iowa, then you can do the preliminary work leading up to that and telling the, preparing the lawsuit, and you can do that in Iowa if you reasonably believe that you will be authorized by the court to appear in that case. And then there's the rules for arbitration are somewhat more broad than for litigation. So it's if you were involved in a dispute and the case is going to go to arbitration, chances are you can appear at the arbitration even if the arbitrator happens to be in Chicago, even if you're not admitted in Illinois. But even in that situation, you have to be careful because the rule has some specific conditions. It has to reasonably relate to your practice here. You can't go to Chicago and find Chicago cases. It has to kind of arise in Minnesota, at least reasonably related to the state where you're admitted. And the state where you're doing that does not have a rule saying that you need to be admitted either permanently or pro hac vice. So those are the situations where you, as an attorney in this state, be that Minnesota, Iowa, or Wisconsin, can go practice law in another state. The next part of the rule kind of says the same sorts of things, but it talks about the situation of whether an attorney from another state can come to this state and do things. In hour six of this program, we're going to talk about the choice of law provisions. But basically, you're subject to jurisdiction in the state where you're admitted, and you're also subject to the jurisdiction of the state where you are doing things. This portion of the rule would apply to a lawyer from outside of this state if he or she is doing things in this state. But just like the Minnesota, Iowa, Wisconsin lawyer is allowed to go to Illinois, well, the Illinois lawyer is probably allowed to come to Minnesota and do a certain number of things. First of all, the requirement is that that lawyer cannot be suspended or disbarred anywhere. Now, Minnesota and Iowa say that you can't practice law, you can't do any of these things in Minnesota or Iowa if you have been disbarred or suspended anywhere. Wisconsin, that could run into problems. You know, if you're admitted in Illinois and then you just decided to drop that and you didn't pay the fee, and maybe you get suspended in Illinois and it doesn't really matter to you because you're not practicing there anymore. Well, the Minnesota lawyer suspended in Illinois can practice in Minnesota, but maybe he can't go to Iowa or Wisconsin because of that rule. So that's something you want to watch out for. Make sure you don't get suspended in some other state. Wisconsin covers that situation a little bit better because they say that you need to be suspended for disciplinary reasons or medical incapacity. So if you're just suspended because you decided not to renew your Florida bar dues this year, that's probably okay. But if you're a North Dakota lawyer who was suspended for incompetency in Iowa, well, then it probably does apply and you shouldn't be practicing. But Minnesota and Iowa basically say that you can't come here and practice if you've been suspended anywhere. But anyway, provided you're not suspended or disbarred, you can come into this state. First of all, if it's something arising under federal law and you're authorized under federal law to do it. So if you are representing somebody before the Federal Communications Commission and you're admitted in Maryland and you come to Minnesota and you're providing legal advice to your radio station client here in Minnesota, that's probably okay because you're probably authorized under federal law to do that. And also you can, kind of reciprocally, those other things where we said you could do it. The Minnesota lawyer can go to Wisconsin and take a deposition. Well, the Wisconsin lawyer can come to Minnesota to take a deposition. But there are two things that you can't do. You can't establish an office or systematic presence in the state, and you can't hold out to the public that you were admitted to practice in the state. So, for example, the communications attorney who represents radio stations, and he's admitted in Maryland or Virginia, he cannot set up an office in Minnesota because that would be a systematic presence in the state. But he can, you know, fly in to counsel individual clients. And he can't do anything that would represent him as being admitted in Minnesota. Iowa has kind of a special rule for if you are employed by a company that has offices in many states, they have a specific rule on what you're allowed to do based upon that. So if you're in Iowa and you work for a multi-state corporation, you can take a look at that rule. Wisconsin, like I said, you have jurisdiction, the Minnesota Lawyer's Professional Responsibility Board has jurisdiction over an out-of-state attorney doing these things in the state. One little twist that Wisconsin adds to it is that by doing any of those things, by taking that deposition in Hudson, Wisconsin, in your Minnesota case, one thing that you've done is by doing that you appointed the clerk of the Wisconsin Supreme Court to be your agent for service of process. So if you and I don't think the rule says, you know, that just for legal kinds of things. So if you go to Wisconsin to take this deposition and then you get into a car accident, on another trip, presumably the Wisconsin Supreme Court can be your agent for service of process. So that's just a little twist, but they would probably have jurisdiction in that case anyway. Okay, so that's practicing out of state. Another thing about the independence of lawyers. Remember, the kind of the overarching rule is that the client is in the driver's seat and you have to be independent so you can follow your client's directions. Well, you cannot restrict your right to practice in the future with some exceptions. So for example, in general, lawyers can't enter into covenants not to compete. And that's what this does, because then you're saying, if you make a covenant not to compete, I will not practice law in Ramsey County for the next year. That interferes with your independence, because if 6 months from now a Ramsey County client comes in, you have to tell him, no, I will not take your case in Ramsey County because I gave away that right. I'm no longer independent. So you have to watch out for that. And again, the general rule is that you can't do it. A lawyer may not participate in any kind of business arrangement that restricts your right to practice law after terminating the relationship. And there's a pretty narrow exception that includes some conditions that talks about cases involving retirement benefits. So if you're retiring, then maybe you can put it in there, but you have to comply with that. Notice that the rule does not merely say that is unenforceable, and it probably is unenforceable, but even entering into that contract subjects you to discipline. So it's not just a case of, we'll put it in there, but it's not enforceable. No, you will get into trouble for signing the covenant not to compete. And even though you didn't draft it, you don't want it, you know it's unenforceable, but still, you are participating in that business arrangement that restricts your rights. So you are violating the rules by doing that. If the other person is a lawyer, then they might be violating it too. But if you're working for somebody other than a lawyer, if you work for an insurance company and they're not a lawyer, and you enter into a covenant not to compete, that you will not do any business whatsoever in Minnesota, well, that restricts your right to practice law. So they're not in trouble because they're not a lawyer, but you are. So watch out for those. Okay, responsibilities regarding law-related services. Here's one where the states differ a little bit. Rule 5.7 in Minnesota and Iowa, have one rule, and then Wisconsin does not have the rule at all. What this rule is talking about is, if you Sometimes you see billboards, you know, saying, you know, divorces $500 by a paralegal. So there's things that maybe 20, 30 years ago would have been clearly, you know, the unauthorized practice of law. Now they're a little bit more liberal. Helping somebody fill out documents. You don't necessarily have to be a lawyer to help people fill out documents. So there are some people out there doing business as these law-related services, you know, helping people fill out divorce petitions or maybe bankruptcy petitions or something. They're not exactly practicing law, but it's the kind of things that are kind of flirt with the unauthorized practice of law. And first of all, it defines that, but then it goes on to have some restrictions about that. If you are doing that, then you have to be careful. If you put out a sign saying, you know, bankruptcy petitions filled out $500, but I'm not representing you, I'm not giving legal advice, I'm just helping you fill out the forms. Well, you might run into some problems with that. The non-lawyer, if they're doing that, then, you know, it's as long as it's not the unauthorized practice of law, then it's not the practice of law at all because they're not a lawyer. But you could run into problems with that because that's kind of like the practice of law, because when you represent somebody in a divorce case, one of the things you do is help them fill out the divorce petition. You are subject to the rules of professional conduct when you're doing those things if they are not distinct from your providing legal services to clients. So for example, if somebody goes into a non-lawyer and says, help me fill out my divorce petition, well, they're not a lawyer, it's not the practice of law, so there's nothing confidential there. If that person just wants to gossip about what's in the divorce petitions, they're free to do that because they're not a lawyer, so there's no attorney-client privilege. But here, if it really is distinct from your law practice, then the rules don't apply. But if it has to be distinct from your law practice for the rules not to apply. And maybe the only exception I can think of is if you take a part-time job doing tax returns, you know, at H&R Block or whatever. Well, that's kind of, you know, filling out forms for people, and lawyers sometimes do tax returns. You know, it's usually not the 1040 EZ, but lawyers sometimes do tax returns, you know, in estate cases or things like that. So you're probably not subject to the rules of professional conduct. But it has to be distinct from the practice of law. And you're also subject to the rules if you fail to take reasonable measures to make sure that the person taking those services knows that they're not legal services. So if you get a part-time job for H&R Block and nobody even suspects that you're a lawyer, then it's probably okay. But, you know, if you tell the customers, hey, you're going to get a good return from me because I'm an attorney, I'm going to do it right, well, then maybe the person thinks that there's a kind of a semi-attorney-client relationship there. So that might take you out of the protection of this. And then things that you do during the course of that are subject to the rules. And you might get into trouble for bad things that happen. So watch out for that. I don't know why, but Wisconsin never adopted that rule. So Wisconsin does not have a Rule 5.7. But Wisconsin does have a Rule 5.7 covering a completely different subject, and that's the limited liability legal practice. One thing I noticed is that in some cases, like I forget if we're going to cover it. I don't think we're going to cover it today, but drafting wills where you are the beneficiary, your client gives you money. Don't do it, even if you miss that section. There might be sometimes when it's allowed. But one thing I noticed that Wisconsin does is kind of incorporate the substantive law in some of these areas into it. So Minnesota has the rule on drafting wills for clients that just says, you know, what will get you into trouble for it. Wisconsin kind of adopted the old cases saying when will the attorney actually, you know, in that situation, will the will work? Will you get your money? So here's another case where Wisconsin kind of adopts the substantive law of limited liability companies and puts that in their rules. So I won't go into that in detail, but there are specific rules in the rules of professional conduct telling how attorneys can participate in limited liability companies. Now, I suspect the rules are pretty much the same in Minnesota and Wisconsin. I'm not an expert on corporate law, but I suspect in Minnesota and Wisconsin, pretty much these same rules apply, but that's just written into the section of the statute governing that kind of corporation. And Wisconsin also included that language in the rules of professional conduct. So that's Wisconsin Rule 5.7, and keep in mind that it's a totally different subject from the Minnesota and Iowa Rule 5.7. Well, we talked a little bit about your employees, both your attorney employees and your non-attorney employees. Well, here we get to kind of a hybrid, kind of a sticky situation that you have to watch out for, is employment of disbarred, suspended, or involuntary inactive lawyers. So some poor attorney gets disbarred, and he can't practice law anymore, but he needs a job. He's probably pretty good at drafting wills or doing legal research or doing various things related to law. So from his point of view, it's probably better to try to find a law firm to hire him as a secretary or a paralegal or something. You know, that's probably better off for him than getting a job flipping hamburgers or something. Well, it's good for him, but you have to watch out, because that's the kind of thing that can get you into trouble. Because Rule 5.8 talks about when you employ a disbarred attorney. And incidentally, this rule applies to Minnesota only, although some of these cautions that we're going to get to probably equally applicable in other states as well. But this is a unique rule in Minnesota. The general rule, and there's a pretty big exception, but it starts out again with the general rule, is that you may not employ disbarred, suspended, or involuntarily inactive attorneys. That's the general rule, is don't do it. But there are some situations where it's okay, because the guy is disbarred, he knows all about how law practices work, so he can be a secretary. So there are some exceptions to that, but the general rule is that you just can't do it. Don't do it. And the word employ is very broadly defined. You don't just because you're not giving him a W-2 form doesn't mean that he's not employed by you. But specifically what you're not allowed to do is you can't employ him to do any of the following. Give legal consultation or advice. So he can't be the person that clients talk to saying, yes, you should sue, or you need a quitclaim deed, or whatever. That's pretty obvious, because that's what he was suspended or disbarred from, so he can't do that anymore. But there are some exceptions where he can communicate with clients. We'll get to them in a minute. He can't appear at a hearing or proceeding, so he can't go to court with clients. Again, that kind of makes sense, because he's disbarred. There is an exception for cases where non-lawyers sometimes appear. Some administrative agency, sometimes attorneys appear to assist people, sometimes non-attorneys appear. Well, he might still be able to appear as a non-attorney, but the client has to be informed of what's going on. And the client, in that case, has to be specifically informed that, yes, he's not a lawyer. If he's just sitting there as a secretary, he doesn't need a sign in front of his desk saying, not a lawyer. But in that case, the client does have to be informed that this person is not a lawyer. You can't appear as a representative of a client at a deposition. So he can't be the guy sitting there looking like a lawyer at the deposition. There's a very limited exception to that one later on, but in general, he can't go to depositions. He can't negotiate on behalf of the client with third parties. You know, and in some cases, maybe a regular non-lawyer could help do handle some of the negotiations. You know, maybe the secretary could do some of the negotiating, but this secretary can't because he's a disbarred attorney. He can't handle client funds in any way. Your regular secretary, you can say, here, take this envelope to the bank and deposit it in the trust account, because in that case, he or she is literally handling the client funds. But your disbarred attorney cannot do that. He cannot say, here, take this to the bank. He cannot handle client funds in any way. And he can't do anything that constitutes the practice of law. So if they left anything off the list, that's still applied. However, this disbarred attorney is allowed to do certain things, and they specifically say research, drafting, clerical service, so probably legal research and things like that, including all the following. Preparatory work for the lawyer's later review. So he can do the research. He can write the brief. He can gather information. He can write the same brief. He can draft the will. Back in his office. He can draft a deed. He can do the preparatory work for another lawyer to actually sign off on, because it has to be made clear that that's you as the active attorney are responsible for that. He can't have legal advice, so you can't have him sitting across the desk from a client telling about legal things, but he is allowed to communicate either with clients or with third parties over things such as scheduling, billing, updates, gathering information, or confirmation of receipt or sending of correspondence. So the disbarred attorney can probably be the one to call up the client and say, the deposition is next Tuesday. But he probably can't say, we want you to go over these, this part of the transcript before your deposition or something, because that's probably legal advice. But he can handle these little scheduling kinds of things, and also he can't be the lawyer at the deposition, but he can accompany an active lawyer to a deposition, but only for the limited purpose of providing clerical services. So, he can sit there and take notes for the other attorney, but the other attorney has to be there. So it's probably not a real good person to have at the deposition. Now, the main reason, if you were thinking to yourself, well, these aren't too bad, I can handle those. This disbarred attorney, he needs a break, so I'm gonna hire him. Well, this next paragraph might make you change your mind, because at the time of employing such a person, or learning of his status, that secretary that you just hired, you just learned that she was really a disbarred attorney. At the time you hire the person or learn of their status, you must give written notice to the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility. So, before you hire this person, you have to send a letter to the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility saying that I have this person. And it seems to me a letter like that is practically an invitation to come and investigate even the most minor little infraction. So before you hire this person and before you send that letter, you probably should make sure all of your trust account records are up to date. And your business account records too, incidentally. We're not covering that in this part of the program today. But since I went to law school, a couple things have happened there. So you want to watch those rules on your business records, because in addition to the records that you have to maintain about your trust account, You are also now required to maintain certain specific records for your general business account. And also, if you maintain a law practice, you are required to have a business account. Now, I don't know exactly what the contours of that rule are. Maybe if you just, you know, if you're not employed as a lawyer full-time, but you write wills for friends and relatives occasionally, I'm not positive you're covered by that rule, but it's one worth looking into, because that rule says you can't just take your checks you get from clients and put them in your own personal checking account. They have to go into your business account. So that's one thing to keep in mind if you're not employed full-time as an attorney. We have a few minutes left here, so I think we can get through pro bono and accepting appointments today. In fact, that's the last time I did that. I timed it about right because that took about an hour. Pro bono. I'll just quote the rule. Every lawyer has a professional responsibility to provide legal services to those unable to pay. I didn't see anything very enforceable there, so you probably, it doesn't say that you will get disbarred if you don't do enough pro bono. It doesn't say that you won't get disbarred, but it does. I don't think that's definite enough for discipline purposes. So they go on to say that you should aspire to providing at least 50 hours of pro bono service every year. And that can be done in a number of ways, providing services for free to persons of limited means, and organizations, you know, charitable, religious, etc., that provide services to people of limited means. But of that 50 hours that you're kind of that unenforceable goal, most of that, or a good portion of that, should be to assisting persons of limited means. And also, you have kind of this aspirational goal to assist in protecting civil rights and civil liberties, and do those at, you know, for free or for a substantially reduced price. Somebody noticed here that the word shoud, S-H-O-U-D, must be a word that means something because my spell checker didn't pick it up. But it should provide services to organizations that work toward those goals. So again, there's no hard and fast disciplinary standards there, but it does kind of set out that, you know, an hour a week or so is what you're kind of, what you should strive for pro bono. In addition to that 50 hours, maybe more of it should be at a reduced rate for people who can't otherwise afford attorneys. And you also have a separate obligation to participate in activities for improving the law, improving the legal system, improving the legal profession. So you have kind of this obligation to try to keep bettering the system. And you should get out your checkbook occasionally and provide money to the people who provide those kinds of services. Well, in about the next 2 minutes here, Rule 6.2 kind of talks about the same thing, but it's not just pro bono in general, but appointments by a court. The rule says that you should not seek to avoid appointments. So if you're sitting at the arraignment and there are 100 defendants there, and there's somebody not represented, and you're afraid that the judge is going to, you know, look for an attorney to appoint somebody to represent one of these defendants. If you sneak out of the room at that moment, you have violated this rule, because by doing that you are seeking to avoid appointment. It doesn't say that you have to take the appointments, but you should not seek to avoid them, except for good cause. Good cause might be, first of all, that if you did take that case, it would be a rule violation. You know, judge, I can't take this guy's case because I represent his victim. You know, the conflict of interest. You can't take the case because it would result in a rule violation. It would be an unreasonable financial burden. So if You know, if they're paying appointed attorneys $25 an hour, and this case will take, 10 hours of your time, you'd probably make more money doing something else. But that's not an unreasonable financial burden, so you probably have to take it in that case. But on the other hand, if it's an appointment and it's not going to pay, or it's not going to pay enough, and this is the crime of the century, and you're going to be engaged in trial for the next year, and you have to bring in outside expert witnesses or something, well, that's probably an unreasonable financial burden. And you can say, Judge, I want to avoid this appointment because that's just too big a burden for me. Finally, you can refuse an appointment or seek to avoid it if the person's cause is so repugnant that it will probably impair your ability to represent the person. So, even if you don't like DWIs, but the DWI guy needs an attorney, so you can take it. It's not that repugnant. But if it's something that if you're on the board of directors, if you just kind of in general don't like drunk drivers, that's one thing. But on the other hand, if you're on the board of directors of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, and the judge asks you to take this DWI case, well, that might be one case where you say, well, no, I can't take it. That's just so repugnant that I don't want to take it, because that way the guy would not get a fair shot, because it would impair your ability to represent the person. But otherwise, you do have an obligation to accept appointments by the court. So that's where we are going to conclude hour number four today. If you do have any questions, please let me know. Well, if not, thank you for coming. I look forward to seeing many of you next week and in future programs. I have your email addresses now, so I'll probably send you out notices of upcoming things, both live programs, various places, and online stuff. So thank you.
Thank you.